Coffee in Space is a podcast by S. Daniel Smith that puts the best in established and up-and-coming science fiction and fantasy writers in front of you, their readers. Dan's goal is to help you learn more about who they are as people, how they write, and how they live. Whether you're listening to this podcast at home, or in your car, or somewhere in between, Dan hopes to transport you to the crew lounge on an intergalactic spaceship, where you can have a cup of your favorite coffee with science fiction and fantasy authors. So sit back, listen in, and enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. This is Dan Smith. I'm a big science fiction and fantasy fan and a heavy coffee drinker. Got my coffee right here with me today, in fact. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 29 of Coffee in Space. I've got Madeline Ashby in the studio with me today to talk about her science fiction and most recently, the final act of the Machine Dynasty trilogy. And so we're grateful to have you in the office with us today, Madeline. Thanks for joining us and having Coffee in Space with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You know, well, let's just start with you as the author. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your road to publication, anything that might help us get to know you better as the author.
Okay. My name is Madeline Ashby, and I am a science fiction writer and futurist based in Toronto. I am married to a horror writer by the name of David Nickel. And The Machine Dynasty is my series about self-replicating humanoid robots. I'm also the author of Company Town from Tor Books. And most recently, I am the co-author or contributor to a book called How to Future, Leading in Sense Making in an Age of Hyper Change with my colleague, Scott Smith.
I want to spend a few minutes on the How to Future at some point in this interview. So don't let me close this interview without talking about that. Okay. So I was looking at your, bio on the Angry Robot page. That's who published the Machine Dynasty.
Yes,
that's and first of all, you're just a fascinating person as far as I can tell.
I wouldn't go that far.
We'd have to talk to the spouse, I suppose. But I was looking at some, and there's a couple of things that I want to ask you about, just because you know, I find it fascinating. You graduated from a Jesuit university.
I did. Yeah.
Now, we are a pretty open format here. Was that a faith-based decision, or was that to get the degree that you wanted?
It was, at the time it was a faith-based decision, but it was also a money-based decision in that I was receiving extra funding from them that I wasn't going to see from anywhere else. And it was also a program-based decision because I became a member of their honors program at Seattle University. Seattle U at the time and still has an honors program that is admits about between 20 and 25 students a year, and it's a classics program. It was probably like one of the only places that was affordable for to me, at least on the West Coast, where I could do a classics based program. And so we did, you know, the way I always describe it to people is you do Heraclitus to Hitler in 2 years. And so I had a cohort of 24 other students where we were in a literature class, a philosophy class, and a history class together, and usually an elective together. But we covered those core three together in, you know, with the same cohort. So you were like with the same people for 2 years doing this degree. And then you sort of transitioned into the general population of the university to finish whatever your major was. And in my case, I had a double major of English and history. So I did, and then I did departmental honors in both of those. So I graduated MCL with both of those. And in terms of the degree and in terms of stuff like that, what I liked about SU, and this is still true as far as I know of the students who go there, it was a private school, but it was, what I liked about it was that it was so small, but also not tucked away. It's sort of tucked in the heart of downtown Seattle. And there are other Jesuit universities throughout the country. There's another Jesuit university even in Washington State, Gonzaga. Gonzaga is way off in eastern Washington, and it's just kind of in the middle of nowhere. Like, there's not a lot to do. It's also fundamentally, like, they practice a very different kind of Jesuitry, I guess, or like they emphasize different things there. The Seattle U campus, when I was there at least, they're about to get a new president in, so that's like why I mention it. You know, practiced a lot more things like liberation theology, Catholic social teaching, stuff like that. We had a die-in for Father Romero every year, like that kind of stuff. So I guess I would say that it was a faith-based decision, but also a financial decision and also an intellectual decision. And it really sort of enabled me to, it taught me a lot of research skills, taught me how to, you know, engage in a seminar. We did seminar style learning. And it really prepared me in a way that I don't see a lot of other programs preparing their students right at the beginning. It was like getting into grad school classes at the age of 18, which does not happen a whole lot.
No, my son just started his freshman year. I can tell you that's not happening.
Yeah, no, I was really spoiled in that I didn't have to take big, huge 101 courses, with like 300 people. And I wasn't sort of subject to, you know, I got to, you know, deal with my professors one-to-one or one-on-one, not necessarily dealing with a TA or something like that. Not that there's any, like, TAs and adjuncts handle a huge amount of work in today's universities, more so than I ever understood when I was in university, like way more than I ever understood 20 years ago. And they are increasingly handling a huge amount of work, like more so and more so. And they continue handling that work for not a great increase in pay, usually, and without a lot of the same protections that tenure track faculty have. So on the one hand, it was incredibly rare to get this opportunity to have that one-to-one contact with my professors. And on the other hand, I would also say it was probably more equitable. Is probably fairer.
That's fascinating. I appreciate that it wasn't just a faith-based decision. It wasn't just a program decision or just a financial decision. It all kind of worked out together.
It was really interesting. Like I actually went to school in my program was, for example, in my program, there was like a devoted Mormon who could have gone to BYU and taken like a huge amount of, you know, probably could have gotten a ton of money to go there. And I knew other people who went to BYU. And stuff, and we're super excited to go. And she chose our program, and she chose SU, I think, in part because she knew that on that campus, she could discuss faith generally. And I met a lot of people. I met a lot of Jewish students, Muslim students, other students who knew that at least on a faith-based campus and specifically a Jesuit campus, they would be able to access, they would have faith-based services. There would be services for them, and that they could learn more about just religion generally in a comparative sense, and that it wouldn't be unusual to want to study that. So I think that a lot of people end up choosing it because they know that there's common ground, I would say, that like it's sure. it's definitely a place where it wasn't entirely a Catholic campus by any stretch of the imagination. And a lot of people there were, you know, either atheist or agnostic or what have you, but they really liked the tradition. And it's also a great place, you know, it's a lot of religious-based campuses are great places to like study art and study, you know, study other things and study philosophy in particular. It was a really good campus for me. I can't speak to the experience that students are having now or what the demographic trends are there now. I suppose if I open my alumni emails more often, I would know the answer to those questions.
Yeah, I've been getting some of those too. That's good. Thanks for the guilt trip of not answering my alumni mail from my university. Okay, so speaking of your study, so you just said that you studied the classics classics program.
Yeah, yeah.
Your bio also says that you wrote the departmental thesis mm-hmm. on science fiction. So now I'm trying to draw conclusions in my head of how to put two of those, you know, a line between those two dots, the classics and science fiction. So
we actually had a teacher, Father Lee. I don't know if he's still alive, but Father Lee was one of our scholars for literature. And he also taught a science fiction class. I don't think I got to take it though. I was offered the opportunity to do a sort of English literature, like for my English degree, I could do departmental honors and I could kind of do any project that I wanted to do. As long as you find an advisor who was kind of willing to sign off on independent study and give you the course credits, as long as you fulfilled your obligations and whatever, if you could find somebody who would supervise your project and had expertise in that project, then it would get approved by the, you know, faculty of arts and sciences. And so I had to kind of hunt around, but I knew that there was somebody who was teaching science fiction, and I had taken a creative writing course of his, Sean McDowell. And I told him that I wanted to work on, I had read all the Dune novels and I really wanted to focus on those. And Dune was actually, I entered school in 2001. So like entering university in September of 2001 was an experience, being anywhere at the time.
Yeah, sure.
But especially like to be starting this whole other chapter of your life at the same time that America was starting an entire other chapter of its life was like, there was a sense of vertigo there almost. It was very dizzying. And, we had profs who frantically, in the lead up to the Iraq War, actually, on our campus, were frantically trying to work Dune into their teaching plans, like into their lesson plans. I knew somebody, one of our English professors, basically had filed his lesson plan before September 11th, and then immediately, like on the 12th, was talking to the faculty about whether or not he could change it so that he could get Dune back on the lesson plan, and he succeeded. He was really important to him that he teach it that year. So that it was always a science fiction friendly campus, down to even to the fact that Frank Herbert, the author of Dune, spoke there. He gave a commencement address. I forget in which year, but he gave the commencement address one year, and it's the kind of campus where you would get guys like him to give your commencement address, which I thought was really cool. And so I had read, on my own accord, not because I was in class, but on my own accord, I had read all the Dune novels. And I decided, like, I really was noticing, I was really intrigued with some of the themes that I was seeing. And I was intrigued with I just wanted to dive deeper. And I wanted an excuse to, like, read all the books I wanted to read.
That's why I do this podcast, by the way.
And get course credit for it, right? So I actually pitched, based on, like, Children of Dune and a couple of other texts, I said, well, I really want to do a thing on, like, incest in science fiction. And Professor McDowell, Dr. McDowell, was very indulgent. And he's like, okay, well, let's talk about this. And he said, well, this is a bigger theme than you understand. And he actually, like, we went into, like, Stranger in a Strange Land and The Wind's 12 Quarters. And we talked a lot about The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin. And so I ended up writing this whole thing that was, like, this big, giant thing. And that sort of dove into a bunch of stuff. And it actually ended up focusing more on Le Guin's work. And what was really validating for me was that in that year, while I was writing this, she was doing promotion for, I believe it was The Wave in the Mind. And she was at a bookstore downtown in downtown Seattle. She was at the old Elliott Bay Book Company back when it was in Pioneer Square. It's now since moved up to Capitol Hill. It's actually almost directly across from where the campus is. And she came down there and did a reading, and it was really wonderful. And I got to meet her. And when I went up to have my books signed at the end of this thing, I told her, I was like, I'm actually writing a departmental honors thesis on your work. And she said, oh, that's wonderful. Let me know how it goes. Hold on. And then she wrote in the book her address, her mailing address.
Nice. She's
like, well, when it's done, send it here.
Nice.
And I was like, are you sure? And she said, yeah. And so when it was done and, like, I was happy with it and, like, it had gone through its defense process and, like, all that stuff, I'd done everything that I needed to do to it and whatever. I sent it off to her, and I actually got a letter back from her that was handwritten, like a handwritten letter about, like, talking about the project. And she said, you know, you should really be doing more of this. Like, you should study this. Like, you could be presenting this right now. Like, she basically gave me a lot of, I probably wouldn't have thought about grad school as seriously as I did if I had not gotten a letter like that just said, yeah, you've got it, keep going. And it was It was great. It was probably a moment, certainly that night definitely like changed my life, and that hearing her talk about science fiction and like hearing her talk about her experiences and her career and so on really led me to want to be a science fiction writer. I'd always wanted to be a writer. I hadn't necessarily always wanted to be a genre writer. I'd always consumed genre stuff. We were also a genre friendly household. Like my dad watched a lot of science fiction. I still have very early memories of watching Star Trek with him. And like we watched, you know, the original series and TNG, and we watched The X-Files, and we watched, you know, Millennium, and like, you know, all kinds of stuff. And my mom was very much into mysteries and sort of horror, and she was a huge Stephen King reader and stuff like that. So we were really like a genre friendly household. And so I had grown up like really steeped in that, but I hadn't ever really twigged to the idea of becoming like a genre writer, you know, in and of itself, like I am a science fiction writer. That idea had never really occurred to me until I heard Le Guin speaking, and something just clicked where I thought, oh no, I want to be writing about change. I want to be writing about how things change, and I want to be offering people different opportunities, like different visions or ways in which, you know, visions of the way in which things might change. And, you know, once I kind of realized that, it all became a lot clearer for me. It didn't necessarily become easier, but it did give me like an area of focus. I think like the thing that's really nice about publishing in genre or writing in genre is that you focus your efforts, especially at the beginning. I think early on in your career, it can be really like, daunting to just say, it's one daunting to say, I want to be a writer, because like everybody's like, are you out of your mind? You know, and it's even more daunting to say, I want to be a writer, and then not qualify that or add some focus to it. Because when the next question should always be, well, what kind of writer? Because there are lots of different ways of pursuing that career. I know technical writers. I know translators. I know interpreters. I know people who write white papers and reports, and journalists. I'm married to a journalist who is also a horror writer. And we, you know, that's like even outside of fiction. Within fiction, to say that you want to become a writer is like, well, in which medium? You know, do you want to write books? Do you want to write short stories? Do you want to write for television? And that area is only expanding, right? Like that, the sheer total number of media is expanding. So, and then there's this other consideration of like, well, what kind of things do you want to write? And so when I sort of picked science fiction, it was as much to say, I'm going to focus in this area for a while or until I succeed, and like drill down as deep as I can and like really focus on this and learn how to do this one thing. And I'm not going to say I learned how to do this one thing well, because I feel like that's in the eye of the beholder, but it gave me, you know, a way to kind of home in and narrow the focus and sort of tighten in on a thing that I wanted to do, rather than saying I'm going to write everything, I'm going to do one of everything or whatever. And maybe if I had been more ambitious or something, I would have said I'm going to do one of everything, but it wasn't where my head was at the time.
Yeah, sure. So let's kind of fast forward from that point then. Mm-hmm. From when you had, and I had meant to mention Ursula K. Le Guin as well, because I wanted to talk about that, so I'm glad you already did. So then let's fast forward a little bit to when you started actually being published in the genre mm-hmm. specific markets with your science fiction. So what came first? What was your first publication?
Probably like my first like real pro publication was, I think the one that started the Campbell Clock was a publication that I did in Nature. But before that, there had been an anthology publication, which I think like those don't necessarily start your Campbell Clock. Or at least I think that's the rules. I had been published the first sale that I remember making, whether or not it was published first is another story, but the sale I remember making was in a Canadian genre anthology called Tesseract, and I think it was Tesseract 11 that was edited by Cory Doctorow, and he had been a member of the workshop that I was a part of at the time, the Cecil Street Irregulars. And I had submitted a story to that, and it was basically the first like real pro sale, and it was a total it was a real surprise to me that I had gotten in. And the story wasn't really nominated for anything like that or anything. It did get an honorable mention in that year's Dawes War anthology, year's best. So it was really cool to have at least an honorable mention that way. But I think that was probably the first. And then I actually have not done a lot of short story sales. There's a certain kind of traditional trajectory of success in genre, which is that you sell a lot of short stories to known genre markets, and then those editors know you, and then you sell a book. And that's not what happened to me at all. I have never sold a story to FNSF. I haven't sold the story to Asimov's Analog, Strange Horizons,
the usual suspects.
This was in the days before Lightspeed, and even in the days before Podcastle and Escape Pod, which I did. I later sold a story to Escape Pod, but and I've had reprints in Clark's World actually. But I had selling original stories. I had no luck with that. I just had no luck with that. And years later, when I met the editor, the then editor of FNSF, I said, "Oh, you're where all the rejections come from."
True, by the way, listeners. Yeah. That is where they come from.
Yeah, that is where they come from. And then I said, "Do you know that those things all arrive on Mondays?" Because where I was in the world, they always arrived on Monday. And I was like, "Do you know that those always arrive on Monday?" And it just doesn't make Mondays any better. it was a cute moment.
So when did your first book come out then? And which one was that?
2012 or 2013.
Okay.
2012 or 2013.
Was that VN or was that?
Yeah, that was VN.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was VN.
So let's get into the world of that book and the Machine Dynasty then.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I always do, but I try to always talk about world building with authors and how did you create? So I want to make sure I get this right. We have we have replicating androids, but they're not coming off an assembly line what you might immediately, this isn't Terminator here. This is this isn't, Data going back to Star Trek trying to figure out how to, or how to put his brother together. Mm-hmm. This is real replication.
They grow themselves inside themselves. They grow each other inside themselves.
So talk about
reproduce by parthenogenesis.
Yeah. How did you get that? Where'd that come from?
I forget where the actual concept around, they should just be able to reproduce each other came about. I think I was doing a lot of research at the time into sort of nanomachines and nanoscale development and looking at carbon aerogel and looking at those types of things. And I think I had done a master's thesis that involved looking at a lot of cyborg theory and Japanese animation and body horror and stuff like that. So I was kind of steeped in that already. And I started thinking about the reason that robots are clunky is because they, and the reason that they trigger an uncanny valley reaction is an issue of scale, that they don't quite look right. And they don't, because they are using actuators and muscles and joints and so on that are kind of a little bit larger or too small or whatever, they're not human scale at all. And the reason for that is that in order to build them, you have to build them in a way that human hands and other machines can operate them and stuff. And so what would really be cool is if the machines were built from the nanoscale, from the microscopic, the way that human cells are, we evolved to sort of the way that we look today, based on the mechanisms of like tiny, something so small, right? Like from a single cell to this. And so I started to think about like what that would actually look like, and how that would be. And then I thought like, well, but you know, if you had that, and you had a self-repairing mechanism, so that the code of the machine was always within every cell, then had kind of a self-repairing thing, then maybe you would have a self-replicating function, because if every cell has the memory of the total plan, then you should, in theory, be able to grow another one. And so then I was off to the races. And I started thinking about what it would be like to have machines that grew themselves. Like, what would that mean? And what would it mean to grow another version of yourself? What would it mean to meet yourself all the time?
Yeah. And, so essentially you created, the science fiction, mechanical version of stem cells, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. It was. And at the time those were like a much sort of hotter topic of research. Now it's all about like CRISPR and whatever, but at the time it was sort of being discussed a lot, and I was like, well, what would stem cells or something similar at least look like in an artificial life form that was still machine based? Like, if you could take that philosophy of creation, or that philosophy of encoding something, and then apply it to something that was inorganic, like what would that actually look like? And could you create a system that sort of gathered a lot of, you know, rare earths and metals and whatever, and turned it into something else? And would that be possible? And, you know, it's probably not possible, but I also I tried as hard as I could to build them out of materials that were being researched at the time. So they have like carbon aerogel muscles that are about like the fibers of which are about 10 times as strong as human muscle twitch fibers or fast twitch fibers. They had polymer doped memristor skin, which means that the skin recalls the place that it should be, essentially, and in turn like can memorize certain stimuli, which polymer doped memristor cells, those exist. There's research on them. I talked about graphene memory storage devices rather than there being a central brain case or a brain up top, they keep their memories locked in through the spine. There's a spinal column that's sheathed in titanium that has graphene coral that slowly grows over time and becomes more and more dense the more memories you accumulate. And so the skeleton itself can actually get a tiny bit heavier, but just more dense as they remember or gain more memories. And so they were cobbled together of all these like little different, you know, projects that other people were doing at universities and labs and whatever, everywhere. And then I ended up sort of putting them together that way. And it was really fun.
So was the trigger for the first book, first of all, did you envision the entire series or was it just VN?
It was just VN at the first.
So yeah. Was this concept of the replication the spark, or was there the lead character that was the spark, or what came first? Was it this concept or was it something else?
I think I had the idea of sort of, I'd had the idea a long time before this or before that time about someone who was married to a humanoid robot who was in a legal, was in a marriage with them, who understood that they were in a marriage with them, like understood that the person was not a human, was not a quote unquote human being, but didn't know everything that she was capable of. And I actually started a short story that was told from the perspective of this guy who was kind of clueless and like didn't understand what all was going on and didn't understand that his wife was actually a lot more rebellious than he knew. And that she was slowly growing another version of herself inside herself or something like that. And like the story just kind of wasn't landing. Like it wasn't going anywhere. It just wasn't you know, couldn't stick the landing. And I didn't know like where to end it. And I realized that the story was a lot more interesting if it was told from the perspective, not of this guy, but of the androids themselves, of the humanoids themselves, because I, you know, there at the time, there were a ton of stories about, you know, humans versus humanoids or humans in relationship to robots or whatever. And there were a lot fewer from the perspective of the artificial consciousness itself, or the quote unquote artificial consciousness. And I really, like, once that idea kind of landed in my brain that I wanted to do a story told from the perspective of people who weren't human, then it got to, like, that was a lot more exciting for me and a lot more fun. And I realized that it would be really interesting to tell the story of one of, you know, one of these little girl robots who had to grow up very fast. And that's why, that's, so then I had the idea of, well, how would you do that? Well, I guess you would have to internalize a lot of the material to grow more of yourself. Well, how would you do that? Well, I guess you'd have to attack another robot. And so the in the opening chapter, the prologue of VN, that first book in the series, this guy, another sort of hapless human character, watches his little robot daughter eat her grandmother on stage at kindergarten graduation, and she essentially unhinges her jaw and like inhales her almost, and at the end she's, you know, sort of a grown-up looking robot.
Yeah. And the only reason I, folks, the only reason I'm pausing like that is because that just really, like, I don't want to say blew my mind, because that seems fake, but like it really, like, that was an awakening moment for me. Like, that was like, oh, okay.
It's, I real. Wanted I wanted it to be, because I've had people say, like, I can't believe you did that right away. Or like, you know, oh my, what is even happening here? And I kind of wanted it to be really clear to the reader, to the audience, how crazy things were going to get right away. Like, this is how it is. This is the tone that we're talking about. Like, this is the style of book that it is. This is the state of play. The, you know, this is the field of that we are engaged on. This is what the battlefield looks like, I guess. And if you couldn't hang with that, if that was not the book you wanted to engage with, you would know really fast. It wasn't going to be like, I'm going to lead you down the primrose path and then slap you in the face with all this violence or whatever. I wanted the reader to know, like, right away what things were going to be, and editors to know right away too. Cause like, I feel like there's a lot of soft kind of openings in books that are there to like get editors past the first chapter, the first three chapters or what have you. And then, you know, then the more hard hitting stuff comes, or then there's kind of more of a turn or a betrayal of the reader in some way. And I didn't want to do that. That felt really manipulative. That always feels really manipulative to me. And it always feels, whenever that happens in a book, I always think like, oh, you got stuck. You got stuck. And the only way out of it the only way you could find out of it was to shock somebody, or to, you know, to shock the reader so much so that they would ignore all the other things that were going on on the other side of the frame, or going on in the background, right? And so whenever I see stuff like that, I'm like, oh, you got stuff.
And it's like, when in doubt, kill somebody.
Right. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you know, bring out the gun or whatever. And I just didn't want to do that. And I wanted the reader to know exactly what kind of thing that they were getting into right away. And also, you know, it's nice to start a book off with a bang, kind of, you know. It's nice to give, to like really be propulsive. The entire first novel is basically like a chase, one long chase sequence. And so for one long chase sequence, you kind of have to give somebody reason to run away. And this was a big thing to be running away from. And so I was excited to do it that way. And I think, yeah, it was when I looked back to, I read it again for the third novel, because like I wanted it to be fresh in my mind. And when I read it again, I sort of, that many years later, I thought, like, oh wow, this was a lot to do, because I was like probably in my, God, I would have been like, when I first wrote those scenes, I probably would have been like 25 or 26 maybe, and maybe even earlier, I don't know. And to think of myself at that time doing it that way was like, wow, you were so, this was a lot to do at the time.
Yeah, and let me focus on these dates for just a second, because sure. Like VN comes out, and I'm looking at the screen here, July, okay. End of July of 2012. So that's right. When VN came out. So that's when this chase scene starts. And then ID, which is the second book, came out about a year later, a little less. But you didn't return to it until, so Rev just came out this year.
Yeah,
so 2020. First of all, there's a, you know, sorry you launched that book in 2020. That's a rough time to be doing anything. But
a lot worse things could have happened.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
Okay about it.
But what was it like? You say you read VN again to kind of re-immerse yourself. What was it like returning to this series, if you will, after taking some time off?
It was really interesting, because the first book takes place from Amy's perspective, and she's kind of young and fearless and just starting out. And then that third book takes place from the perspective of her grandmother. And her grandmother is a lot more jaded, a lot more cynical, a lot more pragmatic. She's also like pretty evil, but she's or identifies herself that way, I would say. And other people identify her that way. But she has a very different view on things than her granddaughter does. And they become kind of two halves of a whole. And they each have their merits, right? Like their viewpoints each have their own merits. And so it was really interesting to also inhabit the older person looking back on those things. Cause it was really about like having done some aging myself and sort of understanding them both. Like I was in a position to understand both of them in a way that I don't think I would have been necessarily. Cause I had written like 90% of that book, but it just wasn't sitting right. It didn't work. It was a really broken book for many, many years. Like I was really stitching it together and like, rearranging it and arranging it and like really trying to get it right and what have you. And it just like was not coming together. And I had to do work on myself before it would be good. Like there were things I had to do before I was capable of doing it. It was like the vision that I had was not, like my reach had exceeded my grasp, I guess. Like there was this thing that I wanted over here and I just like was not flexible enough to get there. And I had to do other projects. I had to sort of learn more about myself. I had to fix a lot of my mental health. I had to sort of, you know, get to know myself better, all kinds of stuff to just complete this thing, to do it the way that I wanted to. And for it to come out as a like suitable ending. Cause I feel like I could have hacked together something, but it would not have been what I wanted it to be. And I don't think it would have like been good for the people who had been there from the beginning. What I have heard from people about this third one is like, oh wow, this is very different to the other ones, but it's also better. And that's cool. What you want. You want it to end like on at least a high note, or if not a high note, then like on something that's resonant. On a resonant note.
Yeah.
I think it does do that.
Okay, so do people need to start at VN or can they jump in? So we need to start
absolutely.
At VN. So
absolutely.
In the show notes, folks, we'll put the Rev in there since it's the one that came out this year, but start at VN. I'm glad that you said that because that's the one I started at.
There's also, I will say, Angry Robot has since released a digital omnibus of all three books.
Oh, good to know.
So there's not a print edition of that, but there's a digital omnibus and it's got all three books and it has essays from people who have taught the books, like professors who have taught the books.
Wow, that's nice.
At their universities, and then like an afterword from me, and like the afterword is sort of about finishing up the series. And then there's also like In the afterword, there's like a little playlist that you can put together and like fun stuff like that. So it's like, if you want all of them together, you can definitely get all of them together. But if you want the print editions, if you like your shelf to look a certain way, then you'll have to do each individual print edition.
Well, as a military guy who deploys, I value digital copies of everything.
I
can stick them on my phone and just read them as I go. So I'll link to that stuff too.
Awesome.
Okay, so we have we've gone for a while here, and it's just because it's interesting. I promised I'd get to How to Future, and I really want
thank
to.
You.
So talk a few minutes about How to Future. It's obviously different than what you're talking about with the with your fiction. So talk to me about How to Future.
So How to Future, Leading in Sensemaking in an Age of Hyperchange is out now from Kogan Page Inspire. And I had been approached by a different publisher to do a book about strategic foresight, which is, you know, my quote unquote day job. They tend to get done late at night, no matter what kind of job they are. So I don't know. I wouldn't call it a day job necessarily. I have a master's degree. My second graduate degree is in strategic foresight and innovation, and it's a design degree, despite my total inability to draw a straight line. And I've been practicing as a freelance foresighter and sort of strategic foresight consultant since the time that VN came out, because actually I graduated from that program in 2011, and I've been, you know, at that ever since. So it's almost, in terms of like from the moment I've been working, I was working on like long-term projects at the graduate level since 2010. So I've been at it for about 10 years. And I was approached by somebody who said, oh, can you do a whole book on this? And I said, well, no, because one, I'm on contract to do a book for somebody else. And if I publish a book with you, I'll be in breach.
We would not want that. And get sued. Yep.
and that would be bad. And also, I don't necessarily have a whole book in me about this. But you know who does are the people that I work with. And they would also do it better than I would. And their names are Scott Smith and Susan Cocksmith. And they together co-founded a boutique sort of bespoke foresight firm called Changist. And I work with them on a fairly regular basis. And what this led to was us developing a proposal and so on. And we, you know, we ultimately, like the things that we wanted from this other publisher, like they couldn't quite meet the terms that we wanted and so on, but we still had this great proposal. And we shared it with Kogan Page, and kind of the rest was history. Like they said, like, we sent the proposal, and I think like within 2 days we heard. It was like, yeah, get started. Can you be done?
Yeah, right.
Was this. And we said, I think we gave them a very, what in retrospect might have been like a foolish figure, but in terms of our possible deadline. But what it enabled us to do was put it out, or for Kogan Page to put it out, in 2020. And obviously with 2020 being the year that it is, I think there were a lot of, you know, I think people are really concerned with, you know, future, like looking at the future, like looking at trends, looking at what is possible, having more conversations about what is possible. And How to Future itself is sort of the practical tactical guide to imagining different futures based on evidence, you know, how to do sort of the kinds of research that we do, the kinds of scanning that we do, the kinds of imaginings that we do, and really have a more meaningful conversation about many possible futures, not any one particular future or any one quote unquote official future. There's a lot of literature written on this already. Like, frankly, there are other books on this subject. Like, it's not just us. But a lot of those books are written for people who are either already practitioners of it, or they're written like for people who are getting a PhD in it or something like that. Like, they're written they're often very dense, and they're often very jargony, and they're often kind of impenetrable to read. And what we had been seeing in our work is, one, we had been asked, a lot of our foresight clients, like, well, what is the book on this that I can read? And we kind of just didn't have the right answer. Like, the thing about a lot of these books are not only are they impenetrable, but they're often like specialized in one area of the field, like the art of the scenario or something like that. And so they're not necessarily something that is an introductory text or a text that is more open to a lot of people, that introduces a lot of different methodologies at once. And we wanted to write the book that we had been asked for. Like, you know, we had gone all over the world. We have been all over the world and heard the same question. And when you go to a bunch of different places and people ask you the same thing, usually it means that there's a need, that there's a gap in the market. And I think that that's kind of borne out, that people are really excited about it. And I'm very pleased about that.
That's awesome. I'm going to have to get a hold of it.
And, I hope you enjoy it. Well, yeah, I hope everybody enjoys.
Yeah, but yeah, I'll take a gander at it, and then maybe someday we could have all of you on and
that'd chat be lovely. About a little bit.
Okay, so in the closing minutes, tell us how we can get a hold of you, connect with you, read your writing, things like that.
I'm on. I'm at MadelineAshby.com, and I'm on Twitter at MadelineAshby. Those are probably the two best places.
And then I just assume either go to Angry Robot to get your books, or Amazon, Barnes and Noble books.
Yeah, no, they're everywhere. Like they are in every place. I would say this year, especially, go to your indie bookstore if you can.
Absolutely.
You know, support your local businesses. They are the ones who are going to be here for you in the moment of collapse. Let me tell you that. definitely 2020 is the year of make friends with your neighbors and stuff. So I think that there's, I would say, you know, if you can, like, embrace your local indie bookstore, and see if they are carrying stuff. And then, otherwise, yeah, like they're available everywhere. If you're curious about How to Future, you can go to howtofuture.com and, read about the book there. Kogan Page also sells the book directly. If you're curious about what we do in our futures work, you can go to changist.com or howtofuture.com, and there you'll find out more about what we do, how the book came to be about, sort of more about the table of contents, stuff like that. And that's all there.
That's good. I'll link to all that and make sure it's in that. You mentioned the indie bookstores and whatnot in the neighborhood, getting connected with the neighborhood. We just moved to Virginia from Southern California.
Oh, wow. What a change. Yeah,
good times. We do love Virginia, though. Yeah, it's a big deal. So, but we are in a couple of weeks going to have a local bookstore on the show to talk about, you know, recommendations for Christmas and whatnot. So I'm excited to have a local indie store do that.
That'd be really nice. Yeah, that's a really good idea. And yeah, I hope more people do that, because it is coming. And I think that, you know, I have to imagine that more people are reading now in isolation.
I would think so. Right?
I mean, I had people tell me, like, oh, you've got two books coming out in 2020. That's so terrible. And I said, well, why? Like, there's, you know, people are at home probably reading more than ever. A lot of people with time on their hands. There's a lot of people with time on their hands. A lot of people, you know, I do think that if there's any, like, one good thing that can maybe come out of this, is that people are, you know, maybe commuting less, or like having more time at home, investing in things that either makes their homes better or their home life better, whether it's like, you know, exercising at home more, or like reading more, or reorganizing your house or something like that. Or you moved, right? I mean, like, there's nothing like being isolated in your house, being quarantined in your home, to make you sort of look around and realize that your house isn't working for you anymore. Yep.
Well, Madeline, thanks for being my guest today. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. I'll have to have you on sometime. You know, after the summer, I want to talk more about this stuff.
Absolutely.
I've got scheduling issues, but I definitely want to have you back on. You're a really great guest to have.
Thank you.
Hey folks, thanks for listening to the podcast today. I really appreciate it. Take a look at Madeline's books, wherever you get your books, and please subscribe to the Coffee in Space podcast. I'm Dan Smith, and I can't wait till we meet again over a cup of coffee in space.